June 13th, 2021. Let's talk this morning about continuing the oral Torah. Now, the last two classes were initially entitled, and we said it in the class, the written words of Torah. I think they were number 5 and number 6. They were now renamed to continuing the oral Torah, number 1 and number 2, which means this is the third in that series. It doesn't change anything other than organization and SoundCloud and things like that. But thematically, you may have followed that those two classes were connected, and this in turn will be the third, either the conclusion or maybe the close to conclusion of this discussion. But very briefly, what we're up to in this general discussion is, what we've been discussing is how together with what we know as the written Torah, the Torah Shebichtav, there was throughout this oral tradition. Now, the question was, once we had what the Gemara describes as a heter, a permissibility in Daf Samech and Masechet Gittin to write down the oral Torah, how much of it was either ideally or realistically continued in an oral fashion? So we've analyzed this from several vantage points. And most recently, in last week's class, at the end of the class, the second half of the class, we talked about the role of the ta'amim. It was a suggestion maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago of Itai Lahav. And we kind of took off on that, on the role of the song which accompanies Torah Shebichtav. And the suggestion, that and one other vantage point in last week's class, was that bad bevad, together with the Torah Shebichtav, as it was received, as it was given to us, was this almost meta level, this above and beyond transcendent realm of continuity, of creativity, which accompanied the written Torah and was purposed to be this realm that we should tap into above and beyond what the words say, which means to say there was from time immemorial, from the very beginning, if we're to accept ta'amim from that early on, the Gemara calls it halacha l'Moshe miSinai, it's not just something separate, which was ultimately closed. It's from the very beginning, this continuity, this oral dimension, this above and beyond, the static text of Torah has been a reality for us. So I'd like to begin this class with just further and, you know, putting final touches on this ta'amim notion of their role in interpreting the Torah, and then bring the class a bit further in that direction, and then veer it in the step forward, I would call it. First and foremost, in terms of discussing ta'amim, we quoted several gemarot with regards to, you know, where the rabbis mentioned ta'amim. I'd like to mention some of the later sources with regards to this matter, and just notice a common thread throughout. First and foremost, in this first source, it's from this book called Shi'urei Rabbeinu Meir HaLevi al Shemot. Rabbeinu Meir HaLevi, in this context, is a reference to not Rabbi Meir Abu La'afia, who lived a good several hundred years ago, but Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik. Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik, who passed away just a few years ago, he was a son of the Brisker of Rav Velvel Soloveitchik. So his students collected some of his teachings al HaTorah, and here it is in his book on Shemot. If I was home, I would show you the book. I'd show you all these books. Anyway, on page Kuf Pehe, he writes, commenting on the Pasuk, Moshe Yidaber Veha Elohim Ya'anenu Bekol. It's an enigmatic, a hard to understand Pasuk, which describes Ma'amad Har Sinai. Moshe was speaking, and God responded Bikol, with a sound of some sort. I'd like to maybe later this week talk about that word kol. We've discussed it in the past. It's a controversial word in the context of Ma'amad Har Sinai, but I'd like to develop it further on another occasion, maybe later this week. Regardless, says Targum Yonatan on that pasuk, Min kodam Adonai hava mit'ane bekal na'im. Well, those are the interesting and most important words, the kal na'im part. The description is that in front of or in the presence of God, there was a response, bekal na'im. Na'im, of course, means pleasant. What sort of reference is a pleasant voice? We're talking about Ma'amad Har Sinai. I don't know about you, when I imagine that scene, it was booming sounds, the thunder, the lightning, the trumpets. What's the kol na'im? What's the pleasant sound? That's what Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik asked. Sarich biur ma hashayachut shel kol na'im u'meshubach le'netinat ha-Torah. Why are we referring to a pleasant sound at the time of the giving of the Torah? He answers based on the Gemara Masechet Arachin and Daf Yod Aleph. The Gemara over there is searching for what's, so to speak, a remez, a source in the Torah for shira, for appropriate song of Hallel, of praise of God. And the Gemara cites this pasuk, Moshe Yedaber V'ha Elohim Ya'anenu Bekol, so suggested Rabbi Soloveitchik, and we'll see in just a moment, he was preceded several hundred years in this suggestion, that this Targum Yonatan is a reference to the Ta'amim of the Torah, which means to say at Ma'amad Har Sinai, in the collective imagination of the rabbis, there wasn't just words spoken, there were words sung. That's right, Jeffrey Dweck, sung, the importance of song to the cognitive, intellectual continuity and formation of Torah. In fact, in parentheses at the end, he quotes from Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, that's his grandfather, who he in turn heard it from his father, the Brisker Rav, that Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik would say that Shirat HaLevi'im, the way the Levi'im would sing in the Mishkan and the Mikdash, that is, so to speak, the precedence, the precursor to Ta'amei HaMikra, to the Ta'amim we have in the Torah. Why am I mentioning this in our context? Again, the significance we mentioned in the past, the traditional impact, the continuity of the songful, transcendent realm of Torah is felt and is present throughout. I have a book, it's called Ma'amad HaNivhar. Ma'amad HaNivhar is a fat book which analyzes and discusses and elaborates upon midrashim that all have to do with Ma'amad Har Sinai. It's a book, his name is Rabbi Weiss. I imagine he's still alive, published a book even more recent. Anyway, in it, he'll quote the midrash, short, in brevity, and then underneath, he'll have sources from here and there and everywhere that analyze what the midrash or what the rabbi stated. So it's a fascinating read on many levels, especially when you want to research something that has to do with Ma'amad Har Sinai. So on this matter, he has the full scope of sources on this matter, and we'll very briefly bring you through some of them. Mahazor Vitri goes all the way back. It's purported to have been a student or somehow related to the teachings of Rashi. Mefaresh ta'ameh haniginot hem she'ne'emru le'Moshe mitoles u'mizokef u'mi'omed u'mi'oleh u'mi'ayored u'mi'amunach. The ta'amim are, so to speak, the way Moshe from God transmitted the way in which these words are climbing and going down and going up. It's a description of the life of Torah. He quotes from the Ragachava, Rabbi Yosef Rosen. That's what Michilta says, Shenitena Torah b'ne'ima. So Rabbi Soloveitchik was already preceded several decades by the Ragachava, who suggested that that's the ne'ima of the Torah. It's not only a Targum Yonatan, it's a Mechilta. He goes onward, he quotes from Sefer Hasidim. Sefer Hasidim talks about the fact, states that Sefer Hasidim goes back to the time of Rabbi Yehuda Hasid, that's 900 or so years ago in Germany, how there are different ta'amim and they shouldn't be mixed for Mikra, for Hamishah Hamshay Torah, for Tehillim. I mean, I'm always embarrassed when we do the tikkun on Leil Shavuot that I don't know all the ta'amim. I know ta'amim for Mikra, I know ta'amim for Shir Hashirim, for Tehillim, maybe for Rut and Esther. But then you get into these, dare I call them esoteric books, and it's always the hardcore Halabiyah, they're all able to carry us in ta'amim over there. I wasn't taught it and I don't know it, but there's a separate set of ta'amim for almost all the books. I mean, again, for Haftarah, which is Nevi'im, so we have one. When you get into Kitubim, each one has its own. As a matter of fact, I'm not embarrassed about this, and Jeffrey was making fun of this earlier on the other end, but until just recently, until maybe 10 years ago, I didn't know what Syrian ta'amim to Megillat Echa, right, Ma? That sounded like. I only knew the Ashkenazic ones. So it's true, I knew... Yeah. We don't reveal that publicly. Yeah. No, now we know it. Now we know it. Yeah. That's right. We spent enough time in Camp Morasha. I spent it in Yeshivota as well, where we only heard in the Ashkenazic trup. I can't even call it ta'amim. Yes, Ricky. That's an interesting thought. What's that, Ma? Echav Ashkenazim makes you cry. Echav Sfaradim makes you want to get out of synagogue. Indeed. Irrespective of all that, you know, sociological realities, what I can tell you is what's being stated over here is there's a separate life, a separate dimension to each of these books, which gives it not only a beauty, not only a pleasantness, But beyond that, it gives it an ability for us to tap into things that don't meet the eyes in the static words of the text. Arizal, in the third paragraph over here, as quoted in Sha'ar HaKavanot and Piriyat Chaim, Dekshaya kore eze parasha o eze pasuk min haTorah, min Nevi'im, min Ketuvim, haya omro kefi nigun ta'amo mamash im Torah im Nevi'im. He used to read, and he wouldn't just state the pasuk, he would always say it with ta'amim. Na'ima devarim le'divrei pi chacham chen. You'd imagine that Arizal, who's reaching for those transcendent realms, of course he's not just going to read the pasuk heke, he's going to read the pasuk with the ta'amim. Ta'amim provide ample space for imaginative continuity. Tosafot in Masech Bava Batra, in the next paragraph he cites that this is Chachmei Ashkenaz, this is in Sarfat, it's northern French rabbis from 12th, 13th century. In their days, there was Nigun Echad Letihilim, Umishlev, Iyov. Specific book said the same ta'amim, others differently, and so forth. Apparently, they quotes afterwards, if I'm not mistaken, from Rabbi Yehuda Hasid, that there's some sort of tradition in Tehillim. David, so to speak, implanted or built the book with abilities to have different ta'amim for each pasuk. There were different levels and capacities and abilities of tapping into truths on different levels and capacities in each circumstance. Again, more than anything, the same point we discussed last week, just, you know, pushing it forward in terms of sourcing, ta'amim have had and do have that capacity within a Torah shebichtav context to reach for an oral dimension which was there bad bevad from the beginning. Rabbi Soloveitchik, zichrono livracha, that's Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, who died in 1993. And I mentioned this after the class last week, he dealt with the following. The first time I actually heard this was from someone distant from Yeshiva University. My wife Zahava was in Brooklyn for a wedding, and we were living in Israel at the time, and I was living as a, what they would say, a bachur. So I took advantage of the mere experience as a single man. I lived it as an avreich, as a married guy. So I stayed in the yeshiva pretty much all of Shabbat. I slept at home, but I lived in the yeshiva. I did this 2-3 times that year. Zahava came back for different weddings and events, so I had the ability to, you know. So I went to Se'udah Shlishit. Each week I went to Se'udah Shlishit, a different place. I mentioned it just yesterday. Se'udah Shlishit, okay, parenthetically, Se'udah Shlishit classically, in Rabbeinu Tam's time, no Divrei Torah were said then. We looked at it as a time of somber, sober, mindful thought of maybe the death of Moshe Rabbeinu. For one reason or another, the Chachamim envisioned it. But today, of course, not only amongst the Syrians, but all over the place, Se'udah Shlishit is a time not only of singing in some circles, but of Divrei Torah. Anyway, I went to Rabbi Helman's Se'udah Shlishit, and Rabbi Helman quoted the following Divrei Torah, and he quoted it from an Adam Gadol. He quoted it from an important person. You knew immediately he was talking about someone, he can't say their name. I knew he's quoting Rabbi Soloveitchik, so I ran back home and I looked it up, and I found it in the books from Rabbi Soloveitchik, the following Divrei Torah. It must have been Parashat Yitro that week, and he was talking about this. Anyway, it goes like this. Harambam writes, we've talked about this in these classes, Harambam writes in his Teshubot, that you should not stand during Aseret HaDeberot, as they read from the Sefer, you should not stand. Why should you not stand? Because he likens it to what the Gemara says. We don't say Aseret HaDeberot as part of the Tefillah in the morning. It's the wrong notion. It seems to give strength to the heretics who say that Aseret HaDeberot are the most fundamental parts of the Torah. There's no more fundamental than other. We have 613 mitzvot. And as a result, he said, you should certainly be sitting down. It's wrongful to stand up. The question, in most basic sense, is that there's a minhag Yisrael for many years to stand up. So you might say, as we did, they didn't have Teshubot Arambam. That's why they were standing up. The tradition developed differently. Rabbi Soloveitchik was a staunch believer in Minhag Yisrael Torah. If we're standing up, there must be a good reason why we're standing up. He suggested the following. He says, Aseret HaDeberot in many circles is read with what's called Ta'am Elyon. Anyone who knows Ta'amim from the Sefer knows there's, for the Aseret HaDeberot, different sets of Ta'amim. How so? Well, generally speaking, when you read from the Sefer Torah, they're not broken into the sentences that you're reading, so to speak, the way they were spoken. They're broken up lefi pesukim, for one reason or another. This is the way the pasuk is broken up. Aseret HaDeberot is so as well. Ta'am Elyon breaks them up differently. For example, each one of those laws on the second side, right? Lo tirsah, lo tinav, lo tinav, and so forth, right? Thankfully, I know the Aseret HaDeberot. I was told recently that 90% of our graduates, not only Flatbush, every school I was told, don't know the Ten Commandments. Luckily, I do. Anyway, so in each of those, the way you read it in Ta'am Elyon is lo tirsah. tigdach, end of pasuk, lo tignov, end of pasuk, and so forth. In other words, we read it in a fashion as if, and that's what he suggested, we're reconstructing, reenacting what took place in Ma'amad Har Sinai. Each was a separate utterance. In other words, instead of reading it as one long sentence, it was separate sentences, suggested Rabbi Soloveitchik. What Ta'am Elyon is bringing us back to the event itself. Do you follow? He therefore said it's appropriate for us to stand up for that segment. If you're reading it, Beta'am Tahton, so I've been reading the whole Sefer Torah. Why are you standing up for this section, not for the other section? If you're reading it, Beta'am Elyon, if you're reading it as if you're at Ma'amad Har Sinai, we stood at Ma'amad Har Sinai. We're not standing because it's more important. We're standing because there's Moshe, and there's God, and there are the trumpets, and there's sounds. We're reenacting Ma'amad Har Sinai, but you follow why we're mentioning this in our context. There's again the capacity of the ta'amim, of the ta'ameh ha-mikra, to bring us to transcendental realms, to reenact, to reinterpret what meets the eye in the simple text of the Torah. Yes, Mark Lessler.
Yeah, so do we know like what year ta'amim were written? We don't.
We know the Gemara refers to them. So we know it spans back that far. The Gemara refers to them as Halakha L'Moshe Misinai. Now, there are, this truth be told, it should be a class, there are different types of Halakha L'Moshe Misinai. Harambam has a list in his Hakdamat Perush HaMishnayot of, he seems to be saying, an all-exhaustive list of Halakha L'Moshe Misinai. He's missing, about 100 in that list. And Havat Yair, famously, Rabbi Yair Bechrach, asked this question. So he told you, left out about 100 Halakha L'Moshe Misinai. What has to develop, and it's a long and important conversation, is there's different types of Halakha L'Moshe Misinai. At the very least, we know, Mark, that it goes back a good several thousand years. Does it come to, again, the suggestion of some as we're reading is it was actually at Ma'amad Har Sinai. Need you accept that in order to be a believing Jew? I think not. I think Halakha L'Moshe Misinai can be interpreted differently. But irrespective of that, I'm telling you that the traditional mode of thought is that the Torah is given, is passed on from generation to generation with ta'amim. And that in and of itself is significant for me. You're right, if I could prove it was actually spoken that way at Har Sinai, if I take that in the full literal sense, it's even more beautiful. But in and of itself, that we've traditionally envisioned it in such a fashion is significant for me as well. The Gemara in Masechet Berachot in source number 4 has a derashan pasuk. The pasuk says, Va'etena lecha et luchot ha'even v'atorah v'amitzvah shekatavti lohorotam. And the pasuk describes both the Luchot HaEven and the Torah. What's the difference between Luchot HaEven and Torah? The Derasha of the rabbis is Luchot HaEven Aseret HaDeberot. What's Torah? Mikra. Hamisha Chumche Torah. I have a question. I thought the Ten Commandments are part of our Torah. Are they not? Why would you separate them? Of course, the next words in the Derasha are the most famous ones because afterwards it says HaMitzvah Zo Mishnah. And then it says, Asher katafti elu nevi'im uktubim. Nevi'im uktubim. I remember being in a Talmud meeting and someone suggested something. I don't remember what the context was. Something about Navi being later. And one of the other rabbis said, are you kidding me? Do you know the Gemara? Masech Berachot and Tavhei says, maybe not in that Havara, maybe Brachos Tavhei says that Nevi'im and Ketubim were given at Sinai. Okay, so you have to understand what those words mean in Mishnah and so forth. Not my issue right now. My issue right now is the Derasha of the Hachamim. Why are they splitting Aseret HaDeberot from Mikra? It seems to be one and the same. Again, pointing us in the same direction that Aseret HaDeberot, Ma'amad Har Sinai, the giving of the Ten Commandments, has its own domain. For example, as a result of that, in this book, Birkat Avraham, written by Rabbi Avraham Erlinger, I mentioned him in a recent class, I think. He is a rabbi, he's still alive. He used to be a rabbi in Kol Torah. Rabbi Prague told me he was his rabbi in his third year based medrash. Luckily, I share one rabbi with Rabbi Prague, Rabbi Erlinger. He wasn't my rabbi, but I would go on Saturday nights. This was actually, when I was married, but Saturday nights, a lot of the house, Saturday night for Saudah Shilishid, I wouldn't leave my wife. But on Saturday night after Shabbat, I would go. So this was when I was married already as well. I would go to his home, then maybe 20 guys would gather around and he would give a va'ad. Anyway, so Rabbi Erlinger, who was a student intern of the Brisker Rav, Rabbi Velvel Soloveitchik, he told the following. It sounds like he saw it. And we now know, I read this in a different book, that the individual who was there, his name is Rabbi Shlomo Fischer, who's still alive. He wrote books books called Bet Yishai. Anyway, Rabbi Shlomo Fisher went to the Brisker Rav and he suggested the following. He said, we don't have only Ta'am Elyon for Parashat Yitro, we have Ta'am Elyon for Parashat Vayetchanan. Again, Ta'am Elyon is the different mode of Ta'amim, of reading from the Sefer Torah. Parashat Yitro makes a lot of sense. That's what we read on Shavuot. Well, on Shavuot, we're reenacting Ma'amad Har Sinai. Many people, Sfaradim, happen to read Parashat Vayetchanan. If you go to synagogue this summer, you'll notice they read it B'Ta'am Elyon even on a regular Shabbat, Parashat Vayetchanan. Ashkenazim do not. And yet, if you open to their Chumashim, much like our Chumashim, they have a Ta'am Elyon. So the question was, what's the significance of a Ta'am Elyon for Ashkenazim? You're never reading it with a Ta'am Elyon. Again, if they're reading on Shavuot with Ta'am Elyon from Parashat Yitro, how much I understand. Okay, you're reenacting Ma'amad Har Sinai Parashat on Shavuot. But you're never reading Parashat Vayetchanan. It's almost like you have a set and a mode of reading it, but you're never going to read it that way publicly. The suggestion of Rabbi Shlomo Fisher to the Brisker Rav, which apparently he was very happy about, was, no, but it still exists, because there are different modes and dimensions through which we interpret and understand the Torah. My words, obviously. In other words, the suggestion was that Parashat Vayetchanan, when we read this derasha of the rabbis, Elu Aseret HaDeberot, it means I need to be able to open up to the Torah and Parashat Vayetchanan and say, oh, there's two ways of me understanding this description. One way is simple, part of the Torah. Second way is, let me put my mind, my heart, my focus on the mode of interpretation of being there at Har Sinai, but I'm never going to read it that way. That doesn't matter. It has its own dimension. Why do we mention this again in our context? Ta'amim as an important interpretive what can I call it, mechanism to the Torah, open the possibility, the classic potential for us to interpret, to understand the Torah on levels that rise above the simple reading of the text. Just bringing this in a little bit of a different direction and then moving us really forward. You see, when we got the Torah, as the Torah describes, we were a little hesitant as Am Yisrael to hear the Kol Hashem Elokim. And so if Parashat Vayetchanan, it's described at greater length than in Parashat Yitro, but clearly we were nervous about something. And then Moshe spoke something. The Gemara in Masechet Makot says that it's after the first two Dibirot. We heard the first two, Anochi and Lo Yeh, and then the next eight were given to us, spoken to us by Moshe. Is it really so? We didn't hear it from God. We didn't have the prophecy. Nobody really knows. We can discuss, we can debate what it all means anyway. But for our purposes, we can get the following glimpse of a reality which is significant for us. Ramban Nahmani and elaborated upon by Rabbeinu Bechaye in the commentary to the Torah in Parashat Vayetchanan, Pereke, Pasuke, suggests the following. Here are their words. They say the first two dibirot, the first two utterances, however, in whatever fashion, whatever way, we heard, we comprehended from God in a direct fashion. Hard to understand, hard to wrap our heads around what that means. God doesn't have vocal cords and so forth. Okay, but the next eight, the way the rabbis described that we then heard it from Moshe, what does it mean we heard it from Moshe? Suggests Ramban Nahmani, suggests Rabbeinu Bechaye, and here's the key word that I want, She'ar ha-deberot sham'um, Mipi ha-gevuram, on the third line in Source 6. Avalo hevinu otem mipiv. We, so to speak, had a prophecy, but didn't understand it, quote-unquote, from the mouth of God. Ulekach hutzrach Moshe letargem ulefaresh liYisrael kedei sheyavinu. It means the next eight were heard as a targum, as a translation, as an interpretation from Moshe. Do you follow? Perhaps the most focal, the most critical moment of transmission of the written Torah, according to some of our classical, traditional commentators to the Torah, maybe according to Chazal, were transmitted orally as an interpretation. It was a targum of Moshe. That's a fascinating thing. You'd imagine the moment of absolute clarity when all is distilled, when you're just hearing God's word, so to speak, that's what you're hearing. They themselves tell us it was a targum, to the extent that targum, much like ta'amim, is classically interpreted as being the part and parcel, bad bivad, with the Torah shebichtav. For example, the Gemara Masech Megillah, which we quoted for ta'amim on Daf Gimal, vayikreu b'sefer Torah ta'eluhim meforash v'som sechel. That's the pasuk in Ezra, where they were reading from the Sefer Torah. Som sechel, if you recall, was a reference to the pisuk ta'amim. What Torah ta'eluhim? Again, they're reading the Sefer in Ezra, and there's lots of synonyms. Torah Elohim Zeh Mikra. What's miforash? What does it mean that it was explicit in the way Ezra or Nehemiah were reading it to the people? Zeh Targum. It means that part and parcel with reading from the Sefer is Targum. Of course, we know classically when the Sefer was read in a synagogue, it was read together with Targum, with an Aramaic translation. Shulchan Aruch and Siman Kof Mem Hei says, but we no longer do that. Yemenites, of course, continue to do it. Why don't we do it any longer? Because nobody understands the Aramaic. Okay, nobody understands the Aramaic. We stopped translating it. Or we stopped reading it with the translation. I'll add, we'd be finishing shul 25 minutes later. Wouldn't be very good for us in the era of ADHD. But perhaps we should be translating on our own. That's an interesting question. Mishnah Berurah quotes from Poskim who debate that. Maybe we should translate on our own. Maybe we should open... I don't know, anything I say, I'm in trouble here. I was going to say the art scroll, then people will say the JPS, but how could you do JPS? Whatever, maybe we should open up to the Rabbi Sacks. Everybody seems to like Rabbi Sacks. The Rabbi Sacks translation of the Torah, and you read one pasuk and then read it with the Targum. Maybe that's the way we should do it today. Says Tur, quoted by Mishnah Berurah. No, sir. Why not? Because Targum was transmitted with Ruach HaKodesh to the extent that he goes on and quotes from Tashbetz. Tashbetz, quoted by Mishnah Berurah, says you should read Targum. There's something to reading it, even though you don't understand. But I don't understand it. But it was said by Ruach HaKodesh. Do you follow what's taking place over here? Ruach HaKodesh, part and parcel with Torah, the giving of Torah, we've envisioned for generations, we've accepted for generations the translation, the interpretation of it. We've envisioned, we've accepted, we've transmitted not only in written Torah, but we've tethered it throughout with not only ta'amim, but with a targum as well, to the extent that we can and perhaps should envision the very giving of Aseret HaDeberot as primarily an act of interpretation. Okay, well, that will, for our purposes today, close the discussion of the written Torah being transmitted and given with the oral capacity for creativity, for continuity, for the ability for each of us to continue that, as we called it, the oral Torah. What I'd like to, over the course of the rest of the class today, discuss and elaborate upon is the following, is even within, this is as per text messages with Norman Greenberg after the class last week, even within the oral, the strict oral tradition, outside of the Torah Shebichtav, the Gemara, the Mishnah, and so forth, is there in that realm some sort of embracing of the oral and let's call it open-ended reality of Torah? In other words, what we've discussed and beat around, but never directly on, is once we closed the writing of Mishnah and Talmud, I mean, for example, teach a seventh grade student, first time they're learning Talmud, and you teach them the several opinions, and they raise their hand and say, but I disagree with that opinion. And the rabbi gasps and says, what do you mean you disagree with it? But it's in the Talmud. Is there room for such a claim? Assuming they're not a little boy or a little girl who's learning for the first time. Assuming they're a Talmud Chacham and so forth. And for some reason, and we can and have discussed why not, we've closed it. We no longer disagree, and that's not the way the transmission, it's not the way the continuity works. We accept that, and we'll move on to the next. Was it nonetheless open, even, quote, after being closed, to some sort of continued development within the text of Talmud, of Torah Shebaal Peh itself? Yes?
We just spoke about this in terms of halakha and approach to halakha. The Ashkenazim will look at the... We have different ways of looking at the Gemara, and then from that we approach halakha in different ways, and we diverge from that.
Indeed, says Ricky, in general, the development, but again, you're taking me off the page. Says Ricky, once I'm off the page and I have texts in front of me, how am I going to apply them? I want to know on the page. It's a hard question until I show you what I mean. On the page, is there something open-ended within it? It sounds like not. If I told you we don't disagree with Emoraim and Tanaim, so it's closed. You turned it into Torah Shebichtav. You've turned it into the written words of Torah, so to speak.
You don't think you've taken it out and then adapted it, it was something
I think you have. I think you have to a certain extent. I'm gonna try to prove it. Yes, Mark.
I'm probably quoting the same book that he is, but like we talked about in this book that the Middle Ages, the Dark Ages, when they kind of closed it off. But like the Tosafot, you're saying it's not on the page, But it basically is on the page.
I gotcha. I gotcha. Mark, give me a few seconds. I didn't remember it from that book. I remember if he probably quoting it. He's referring, I think Mark is referring to the book Halakha, the Rabbinic Idea of Law. I will refer to Professor Aleph Orbach, Ephraim Orbach, on that point of Tosafot. But again, Mark, before I get there, I want on the page. You know, the Tosafot, the claim will be is a continuity of the same style. Give me a second to explain to you what I mean. First and foremost, I'll develop it from the following. The Gemara, these first several sources 10 through 14, with the exception of 14, kind of, are from that same book, Ma'amad HaNivhar, of Rabbi Weiss, which I mentioned earlier. The Gemara in Masechet Megillah, Daf Lamed Bet Amud Aleph, Amar Bi Yochanan Kol HaKore Belo Ni'ima. Okay, any person who reads the Sefer without Ni'ima will interpret that as without a song, without ta'amim. Vishoneh milashon mishnah, Torah shebal peh, belo zimra, without pleasant melodies. Alava katuv omer, and a terrible thing you brought, for you gave me chukim lo tovim, and so forth. You're supposed to be, and this was Itai's point, and this I even with my mellifluous voice, sang for you, very briefly, a song that I remember from Yeshiva, Amar Abaye, right? So that's a reference. The Gemara Daf Lamed Bet is talking about singing Mishnayot, to the extent that Tosafot right there says, Shayu regilim leshanot Mishnayot bezimra. They used to sing the Mishnayot. Now, I know, Jeffrey will say, come on, it's Tosafot. Okay, that's why I have several other sources here. Masref ha-chokma yashar mikandia, by Yosef Shlomo del Medigo, rather. He dies in 1655, and, you know, Padua, Italian influences, and so forth. What does he write? Ra'iti mishnayot biktav yad im ha-niginot. V'im b'torash ba'al pekach. What's that? Oh, no kidding. Okay.
I think they were found Mishnayot with markings.
How do you like that? Okay, so Jeffrey took us back only about 1600 years earlier than my sources. I was all proud of 300 years ago. I know we have quoted from Rabbi Shimon ben Semach Duran, from Rashbatz, something similar, but that will only take us back to 14th century. But okay, even better. So there's references at the very least 400, 500, 600, 700 years ago, maybe for Ashkenazim even earlier, that Mishnayot would have ta'amim. Shem HaGedolim, Maran HaHidar, B'chaim Yosef David Azulay. Again, only 200
or so. Sorry.
Oh, in the Cairo Geniza, so it won't bring us back to... No, it's all right. And it doesn't make sense that it would be the Dead Sea Scrolls unless there's something, because you're dealing with, you know, contemporary. But anyway, regardless, it means Torah Sheba'al Peh had songs. They would sing it. To the extent that, and this was first showed to me by Rabbi Usher Stern, who taught in Yeshiva Flapper for a short period, in the book Tiferet Yisrael, is a major commentator on Mishnayot. This rabbi dies in the mid-19th century, Rabbi Yisrael Lifshitz. He makes the following suggestion. He says, you ever learned Gemara? If you did, you may have been a little troubled, a little bit off-put by the fact that the Talmud will tell you the Mishnah is missing words. The Mishnah should have said it like this. The Mishnah meant to say, Hasure mechsera, hache katane. I mean, come on, get yourself together. If the rabbis are telling you without fear that the Mishnah is missing words, that the Mishnah is incomplete, so fix the Mishnah. I mean, well, they couldn't fix the Mishnah. They're telling you to add the words in, so why didn't they add the words in? Suggests Rabbi Lifshitz, and again, this will be the first step, suggests Tiferet Yisrael, it was in order to maintain the melody. It was purposefully written in such a way, he suggests. In other words, if you want to have a beat, if you want to have a melody, I mean, we all know this, there's a certain poetic license. A songwriter, a composer, needs to skip words, needs to use, quote, the wrong word in order to fit the song, in order for it to sound right. The suggestion here, however, is not for the reason we've been discussing until now. We said the song is that transcendent ability, the ability to that gives that you have for creativity. Their suggestion is the more you chant it, the more you sing it, the easier it is to remember. This we know back to the time of Dead Sea Scrolls. I remember reading this in Professor Sarna's book on Tehillim. Ubtorato yehge yomam v'alayla. He says some of the earliest traditions that we know in terms of study of Torah is they would chant it the same way until today. Rabbi Eliach wants Yeshiva Flappish High School doing it this way. If you walk into a cheder across the world, what do they do? My nephew's cheder in Siach Yitzchak in Far Rockaway, I asked him, how do you learn? He says, we chant it and we teach it. They read the pasuk by rote and then they translate and read and translate and read and translate. It's a song, but Apparently, they remember it. I remember early on, I don't know if they still do this, I remember Rabbi Joey Mizrahi speaking in Hathaway and saying that's what they do in Bar Kai. We sing it, and that's how we remember it. Again, the suggestion over here is the Mishnayot were purposefully written, not Pesukim, leave Pesukim aside, in a way in which you can sing it and by so doing remember. It's not about creativity. Of course, our direction will be perhaps there's a further dimension. There's the continuous dimension. There's the ability to envision, to understand more than meets the eye through the song, not only to remember it. A good song isn't just something that sticks in your mind because it has a catchy tune. It also causes you to continuously remember it and think about it. One of the earliest in the last 100 years to write about this, it's in a book called Kobetz Ma'amarim. It's Kobetz Ma'amarim of Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky. Rabbi Yechezkel Abramsky was a rabbi in Europe, and then in Israel, he was a student of Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik. He wrote a major commentary on Tosefta called Hazon Yechezkel. If you walk into a traditional Beit Midrash, they have Hazon Yechezkel as their commentary, as the Tosefta. In Mir Yeshiva, it was Hazon Yechezkel, maybe Hasdei David. You walk into an untraditional one, of course, it's Lieberman's Tosefta Peshuta. Regardless, he has one of the major commentaries on Tosefta today. His father-in-law, Rabbi Yerushalayimsky, or Yerushalayimsky, wrote an article which was published in his book, Kobetz Ma'amarim, on Torah Sheba'al Peh, and he makes the following suggestion. And I'm not gonna read it inside, I'm gonna tell you it basically, at least the paragraphs I put on the page. It goes like this. It says, listen, what are we doing when we open up a page of Talmud? We're trying to get to halakha. Generally speaking, of course, we're trying to understand and so forth, but we're halakha. And the rabbis told us the halakha is like him over here and like him over here and like him over there. Skip the whole thing. Turn it into halakha book. Give me directly the halakha. His suggestion is maybe there's something there which was purposefully implanted for us, so to speak, to enter into the Beit Midrash of lore. Now, we are given the tools with which to know the conclusion, but we have to develop it along the way together with Chachmei HaTalmud, which means to say, getting it to the point that I was trying to make, that I'm trying to make, is within the orally written Torah, let's call it, there was left open a continuous stream of orality. We would never close it and turn it into Pisuk Halachot. We continued it as, what are the words? Shakla v'tariyah, the give and take. Rav Hutner, Rabbi Yitzchak Hutner, in his book Pachad Yitzchak on Hanukkah and Ma'amar Aleph, Od Gimal makes the same point again. Why is it that we have Divrei Torah Aniyim b'makom echad, Ashirim b'makom acher? Why is it that sometimes you understand the halakha best from an out-of-context situation? Why not just place it all in the same place? Why bring me on this, you know, stream of consciousness of the rabbis with the tangents and the digressions and so forth? Again, because that is, even after his words, even after Torah Sheba'al Peh became quote-unquote Torah Shebichtav, even after the heter of writing down Torah Sheba'al Peh, it continued and must continue as an oral tradition. It has to continue to encourage the development, the continuity of creativity, of explanations, of interpretations. This piece in Ma'amar, just very briefly, in Pahad Yitzhak, when I started getting more serious with my wife Zahava, so it was around Hanukkah time, and I brought with me on the day Pahad Yitzhak, and we sat down, a little nerdy, maybe a little rabbinic, and we read this Ma'amar. So I told Norman Greenberg this past week. He said, no kidding, me and Siona also, we learned it together. Anyway, that's this piece in Pahad Yitzhak, so it's very near and dear to my heart. Now, to Mark Lessler's point from earlier, what about post-Talmud? Did we continue this? Absolutely, said Mark Lessler. As Professor Orbach points out in his, of course, monumental work, Ba'alei HaTosafot, on page 677, he says, what are Tosafot doing? They leave open-ended questions sometimes. They write with the dialectics of Talmud very often. They envision Talmud as this continuous process which comes into our day. They're living under 1,000 years after the closing of Talmud, several hundred years after the closing of Talmud, but they're still speaking as if they're Talmudists. That's right. That's right, because the vision for them, as we're suggesting, was that Talmud, that Torah Sheba'al Peh, would and should continue to develop. Now that's in stark contrast to what was taking place in Spain during that time period. As Professor Breuer points out in his book, Ohale Torah, on page 179, It's worth reading in greater depth and understanding this at a greater depth. In the Sephardic academies and the Spanish academies, things were being developed and understood differently. There was a lot more of a focus on the bottom line. There was a lot more of cutting out the shaklavitaria, the tangents, the pedantic side of the Talmud study, the things that seemed less significant. There was a lot more focus on, well, what's the bottom line over here? Which again, cuts out the continuity. Once you cut out the give and take and just focus on the bottom line, it would appear at first glance that you're closing it and turning it into a veritable Torah Shebichtav. Is it so? We'll have to discuss. Again, what are we up to in the class? We've closed out the first part, the Torah Shebichtav, as it continued with a Torah Sheba'al Peh throughout dimension. Now we're on the Torah Sheba'al Peh dimension, the Gemara, the Mishnayot, how they were purposed from their onset and throughout the generations to continuously develop and expand. And we saw it in Talmud. Why is Talmud? Why are Mishnayot written in such a fashion? Either just to remember it, or alternatively, to bring you into the, I remember one of my rabbis saying early on, he said, you want to know why Talmud is written? One of my high school rabbis, to bring you into Rabbi Taller, into the Beis Medrash. That's what he told us. Entering into the Beis Medrash, of course, the Chachmei Talmud didn't call it Beis Medrash. They called it Midrash, probably, like a good Sfarad. But regardless, that's the idea. The idea is that you're supposed to be in there because you're supposed to get into the give and take. Tosafot certainly has in mind, suggests Professor Orbach, to continue that. The Sephardic world seems to be tapering, seems to be moving away from that. Harambam is explicit in several places. That's not the point of Talmud. Most specifically in source number 21. Source number 21 is a letter that he wrote to his student, Rabbi Yosef, and he says to him, don't get overworked in this Talmud. So read my Mishneh Torah. He describes, I wrote Mishneh Torah as, you have your Torah Shebichtav, and then this will be your Torah Sheba'al Peh. I'll give you the bottom line of the sugyot. He says, the Shakla V'Tarya in Talmud, led everyone astray. People got caught up in these tangents. People got stuck in the logic and the underpinnings. And so that wasn't the point of Talmud, he suggests. I always liked in the past talking about the contrast in Harambam's vision between halakha, Talmud, and philosophy. For him, philosophy is all about the journey. For halakha, it's all about the bottom line. Okay, that's his statement. He says, so I wrote my Mishneh Torah. Read my Mishneh Torah. Focus more on the philosophy side of development. You could talk about that and so forth. But when it comes to Torah Sheba'al Peh, I made you a Mishneh Torah, a second Torah. I gave you Torah Shebichtav, you have that. And now read my book. Don't get overworked about that other stuff. Don't get overworked about the Shakla V'Tarya. Very appropriate for a Spanish vision of Talmud. Well, if we're to follow this forward, there are several ironic consequences. Of course, all ending where, well, in my mind, we want it to end, but maybe you want it to end somewhere differently. Bringing this forward to the 20th century. 20th century, in 1918, Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik passes away. Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik was the beginner of, he's attributed with beginning this new mode of thought in the 20th century of a particular dialectical analysis of Talmud, the Poskim, and so forth. His, well, let's figure this one out, his son, grandson, great-great-grandson, Rabbi Moshe Lichtenstein, that's Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein's son. I think it was in 2002, I was in high school when he published this article. I remember Dr. Joel Walwalski gave me this article to read at the time, and then I had the honor, the zechut, the merit, the privilege of meeting with Rabbi Moshe Lichtenstein and discussing this article with him. Now, as a little kid, I didn't understand anything about it, but I thought I did at the time. Met with him in the city, we had this whole cute meeting. I wrote to his brother about something else. I didn't understand anything at the time. Maybe I don't today, but I certainly didn't then, but I had these opportunities. Anyway, in the article, it's called, the name of the article is, you know, just the best part. He called it, "What, quotation marks, hath Brisk wrought?" And then it's something like returning to the Briskum Derech or something. I forgot exactly, reappraising it or something like that. Basically, he has the following. I'm not going to give you his punchline at the end. I'm going to tell you his characterization of this Brisker methodology. He says, what Brisker methodology has done and was purposed to do was to cut out, gasp, pause for a second, the Shakla V'Tarya of Talmud. He says, the give and take, the back and forth in Talmud, that's what a person who's thinking in dialectics, a person who's breaking concepts down, who's conceptualizing, leave all the technicalities aside. Let's break this down. In the final line of Talmud, you have this opinion, that opinion. What do they demonstrate? Now, I can bring proofs. Of course, you have to go through the Shekla Vitaria. You have to go through the back and take, the back and forth, the give and take in the Talmud in order to explain what those bottom lines are. But fundamentally, my vantage point, what am I focused on? What do I care most about? The bottom lines and explaining them in an analytic fashion. He, of course, if you understand that the article is an appraisal, reappraisal, says maybe we should turn back to the back and forth. But do you follow? Do you follow what he's suggesting the Brisker methodology did? It veered off of the approach of the Ba'alei HaTosafot. In our words, it took us away from the Talmudic invitation to get into the back and forth. It says it's closed. Here is the package. Now interpret this package. How do I understand it? You could turn backward to understand it, but don't think you're getting involved too much in that. For example, you know, he tells a story, just if it'll help you. In the third paragraph over here, he says he was learning during the summer in 1976 with his grandfather, Rabbi Soloveitchik, and they were learning about the sugya of Chetzio Eved, Chetzio Ben Horin, whatever the sugya is, and he said that Rabbi Soloveitchik said, we're going to begin with Harambam's words, and we're going to analyze Harambam's words from all over the place. And the students, my words, are wondering, what are you talking about? We didn't open the Talmud yet. That's right, we're going to start with Harambam, and then we're going to move our way into Talmud. In other words, instead of envisioning it as Talmud, now led to Harambam, how does Harambam fit into Talmud? It's Harambam, bottom line, let's understand this. Okay, then we'll see if we can fit this into Talmud, because we're focused not on the Shekla V'Taya, not on the development until this point, but on the bottom line. Now let's understand the bottom line. He suggests that's why the Briskers were so infatuated with Harambam. Harambam, any good Brisker has a book on Harambam. Chidushei Rabbeinu Chaim HaLevi al Harambam. They're always focused on Harambam because that cuts out the Shekla V'Taria. It's what Harambam wanted. Oh, wow. Already there's something ironic that just took place over here. Do you understand the ironic reality? Harambam thought he was closing that Torah Sheba'al Peh, you know, development. And yet, his very words, divorced from the Talmudic lead-up, became a branch of thought, which is continuously developing as well. That, in my mind, is already an ironic consequence of the inability of closing off an oral tradition. But wait, it gets better. Professor Tashman, source number 23, it's in his Knesset Mehkarim, I think in the third one, maybe the fourth, it's in the purple one. He's got four books, Knesset Mehkarim, which were published, all his collections. Professor Tashman was a great Talmudic professor. He worked in several capacities. Anyway, he was a mentor in several ways to Professor Kanefogel, who was my teacher in graduate school. Anyway, he has this article. What's that? I don't know. Maybe he's changed his name. You know, like the early Israelis in the 40s and 50s, they changed their names. You see, Rabbi Yerushalayimsky, that wasn't his real name either. Rabbi Amital of Yeshivat HaRetzion, that wasn't his. I think his name was Klein. He was from the same hometown as my grandfather. But you became a true Zionist. You moved into Israel. You changed your name. You got some sort of kiddushah. So I imagine it wasn't his real name. But, you know, let's accept it. Anyway, but it's very appropriate, you know. Anyway, he says, Ha'omnam, the name of the article, also encapsulates it all. But it's a great article. Nakat Harambam omdam hafchanit klaped limud ha-Talmud. Did Harambam really possess an opposition approach to learning Talmud? Now, he has the sources that we quoted and others about Harambam saying, don't get too caught up in Talmud. Now, my words, because I'm not sure he would say it the way I'm about to say it, but basically what he suggests is, he suggests Harambam wanted it this way, potentially. I'm suggesting it's just the way it happened. Harambam's words brought people to study Talmud more than before he wrote his book. How could that be? He says his expressive purpose is take you away from Talmud. Several ways. First and foremost, if it's a halakha book, you should only be focused on things that are relevant to you, me, and anyone else today. We're not talking about Beit HaMikdash today. Why does Mishneh Torah have the halachot of Tahara, of Kiddushah, of Korbanot, and so many things that are irrelevant today? That already is an oral tradition, which makes me wonder and realize there's something more to this than just a bottom line. Furthermore, Harambam's wording, the words he uses oftentimes, are consistent with the words of Talmud. So he kind of invites you as a reader who might be using modern Hebrew terminology to wonder, why did he use these words? And you'll have to check the source in Talmud for determining that. So he says the wording itself, he goes further and he says, just look at the way it was being studied in his time. Rif was being studied en masse by the communities in the Middle Eastern world. So he writes this, but it's different. It ironically brings people into study Talmud. He mentions in it, look at how Brisk developed Harambam and turned Harambam into a Talmudic methodology. He goes further, he says, look at how Rabbeinu Nisim Girondi, Rabbeinu Nisim Girondi, a great medieval Spanish commentator on Talmud and others, we learned at Ashwataran last summer, he says, look at Ran. Ran will oftentimes say, now I have Harambam, how does he fit into Talmud? Harambam was rolling over in his grave as you say those words. Forget about how it works into Talmud. You have the words of Harambam. Maybe yes, maybe no. It might be ironic, it might be purposed. The point is that as much as someone like Harambam thought, or we thought, was he was closing this Talmudic oral tradition continuity, he was only developing it further, maybe setting it in different directions. For example, just furthermore, one of my favorite sources, source number 24, in Sri De'esh, Chaylik Aleph, Siman Kof Ayin Chet, I remember the first time hearing this from Professor Chaim Angel in the introduction to Bible class, we were learning Sefer Hezkel. Anyway, he was talking about what's Peshat. Now, he was presenting this, as is Sri De'esh, Rabbi Weinberg, an important 20th century thinker, and a negative-ish fashion, but I see it as a beautiful way. He says that someone's writing to Rabbi Weinberg about specific halacha, and they say your interpretation of Harambam isn't consistent with the interpretation of Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, whom Rabbi Weinberg revered. He says, you should know, in his response, it's a beautiful interpretation of Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, but it's not what Harambam wrote. What are you talking about? He's interpreting Harambam. He says, yeah, Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik had Rambam Hadash. Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik had a new Rambam, which of course is somewhat negative if you're a strict interpreter of texts, if you're not a postmodernist. If you're a strict interpreter of text, you say, what was the original intent? That's what Rabbi Angel was trying to say to us at the time. He says, what is Peshat? It's the original intent of the author. Okay, it's a nice interpretation, very anti-postmodernism for those who understand those words. But those words to me are the greatest compliment you could give to him. Rambam Hadash, Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, developed, continued an oral tradition. He took Harambam, who closed Talmud, and he reopened it through Harambam, whether he willingly or purposefully did so or not. Rabbi Michal Shurkin, in source number 25, quotes in his book Beged Giv'ot Olam, Chelek Bet, on page Zayin. One time, Rabbi Soloveitchik was giving a class, he was talking about the words of Harambam, and he said, I know that in the Teshubot of Harambam, in his responsa, he explains his own words differently than I'm about to. Who cares? What do you mean, who cares? What did he mean? Okay, look at that, the ironic consequence of Harambam's closing, which is only continuing in source number 26, in the most recent book, 70 Conversations in Transit. That's Rabbi Aaron Arola Adler, as my mother refers to him. Rabbi Aaron Adler lives in Israel today. He was one of those drivers of Rabbi Soloveitchik in the 70s or the late 60s, I think in the 70s, maybe early 80s. And I unfortunately don't have the page number here. I read the book on one Shabbat, when I was not able to go to shul because of quarantine. And then I just lent it to someone else. I took the pictures from the book that I needed and I lent it to someone else. So I have this picture on my phone. I had it in my files, but I didn't put what page it's on. I'll never see that book again. It's been, I don't need it back. I just need it for this page number. You have it? No, I lent it to Abba and then he gave it back and I gave it to someone else. Whatever, it's okay. Regardless, all I need is the page number. I just need to be able to properly source this. Anyway, he says, Rabbi Adler says, he says, one time I was escorting the Rav back to his apartment after a four-hour marathon Yahrzeit shiur, a shiur packed with sensational navala, however you pronounce that, interpreting difficult Rambam texts. I asked the Rav if he really believed, can you imagine the audacity? I mean, I've been asked this, but asking Rabbi Soloveitchik, that Rambam had all these great ideas in mind while writing his book. I get asked this question all the time by high schoolers. I mean, my answer is the same as his, but, you know, can you imagine asking that after his class? Anyway, he asked him this. The Rav looked at me and said, what's the difference? difference? Was it not a good shiur? I love that line. That's the greatest line. Now, you think he was just brushing him aside. No, he says, the next day I saw Rabbi Soloveitchik's son, Professor Chaim Soloveitchik. And he said, Professor Chaim Soloveitchik told me that it was perfectly legitimate to use a text, halachic or otherwise, as in the United States Constitution, to launch ideas, irrespective of whether or not Rambam entertained those ideas. The very ideas themselves must be considered authentic Torah and treated as such. Very postmodern, very interpreting truth as this expanding. But again, for our purposes, look at the continuity of the oral Torah. How beautiful, how amazing. I will mention in this context, first and foremost, Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, we've quoted this on other occasions. He later wrote an article called Mishneh Torah, something having to do with art. He describes Mishneh Torah as being a work of art. Art, you look at the Mona Lisa, I look at the Mona Lisa, he looks at it, and so forth. We all have a different interpretation, and it's all true. He says, that's what Mishneh Torah really is. That's what a beautiful artistic text is about. Again, closing the text, but maybe unbeknownst to him, Harambam is really just continuing, opening up a new direction of Torah Shebaal Peh. I will tell you, before we even read 27, that Rabbi Soloveitchik himself, this contested legacy, is like any other great person. Can you imagine? His own interpretations to life, to Torah, are contested today. He thought, maybe he didn't, but someone may have said that he was closing it. He was setting forth his ideas, his opinions, and yet they only continue to be debated. For example, his grandfather, this is an ironic consequence as well, in source number 27, Chidushei Rabbeinu Chaim HaLevi al HaRambam, the introduction to the book of Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, his sons, Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, Rabbi Velvel Soloveitchik, they write this introduction and they say, this book is different than any book you've ever read. This book is written, every single word was thought about. So when you read this book, and if you've ever learned in a Brisker yeshiva or heard a Brisker shiur, I don't know if any of you have, it's okay. I mean, you're missing out on a lot, but it doesn't matter. Every word in Rabbi Chaim HaLevi Soloveitchik's book is dissected, is analyzed, is interpreted. Did this happen in Shraga? I don't know, but it happens in the yeshivas all the time. The medaktek, why do you say this word? Can you imagine? It's a rabbi who died in 1918. He thought he was setting forth, or we thought he was setting forth, this is my opinion on the matter. No, we continue. If I was at home, I would show you. The original publication of it was about this thin, very slim, maybe 150 pages. Today, published a few years ago, there's this size, because the bulk of the book now is interpretations to what Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik meant, or to consider it, or how you apply it. Can you imagine? It only flowered, it only burgeoned further for a person, Professor David, what's his name? Professor Berger from Yeshiva University. That's his name? David Berger? Yeah, anyway, Professor David Berger, he wrote this article, I haven't read it in a while, the ironic consequences of things that Harambam wrote, and things that he didn't expect to go in one direction, they ended up going in that direction. One that I remember, again, this would be a primary one, I don't know that he develops in such a fashion. I'll close up. One of them that he mentions, as I recall, is Messianism. He says Harambam very much naturalizes Messianism. He says, Yemot HaMashiach will be a day that we'll recognize. It's not this cataclysmic ending of the world. It's a world in which there's enhanced knowledge and so forth. Can you imagine those who pushed for messianism, messianistic visions, Shabtai Tzvi, early Zionists, they were quoting the words of Harambam. They said, it's up to us. We can't wait for God to bring this. Harambam was trying to scale back the focus on messianism to say, listen, it's somewhat naturalistic, was the proof text for and the driving, the text and mission statement of those who were trying to bring Mashiach, so to speak. So again, over here, there's an ironic reality in as much as closed as we thought Talmud was becoming, as Torah Shebaal Peh was ending, and we were kind of being left with static texts, the song of study has and will continue. I'll conclude with two last sources. First source, number 28, much better listening to than reading, although it's written well. It's in Rabbi Bezdin's book, Reflections of the Rav, Volume 2, on page 21 to 23, but it's online. You can find it on YU Torah. Maybe it was a different occasion he gave it. I think it was said at a Pidyon HaBin for the Karasik family in Boston in the 70s, and he talks about Mesorah. Just listen carefully and understand what's taking place over here. Very much consistent with what we've been discussing. He tells the following story. He's speaking autobiographically. It becomes clear. The old Rebbe walks into the classroom crowded with students. I have to read it. I'm sorry. It's too beautiful. Who are young enough to be his grandchildren. He enters as an old man with wrinkled face, his eyes reflecting the fatigue and sadness of old age. I heard this early on from my father, actually. He used to tell this with a lot of, you know, passion, as you told this. So hearing it from Rabbi Soloveitchik was more exciting for me. This pensiveness, typical of old age, emerges out of awareness of people and things which are rapidly disappearing, which linger only in memory. So here he is, entering into the room, slowly, a little bit nervous. The Rebbe is seated and sees before him rows of young, beaming faces, clear eyes radiating the joy of being young. For a moment, the Rebbe is gripped with pessimism, with tremors of uncertainty. He asks himself, can there be a dialogue between an old teacher, young students, between a Rebbe in his Indian summer and students enjoying the spring of their lives? The Rebbe starts the shiur uncertain as to how it will proceed. He's nervous, he's old, he's out of touch with reality. He's slower. Suddenly the door opens and an old man, much older than the Rebbe, enters. He is the grandfather of the Rebbe, Reb Chaim Brisker. It would be most difficult to study Talmud with students who are trained in the sciences and mathematics were it not for his method, which is very modern and equals, if not surpasses, most contemporary forms of logic, metaphysics, and philosophy. So here he is teaching the class, and then someone back from the death, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, walks into the room. Door opens again. Another man comes in. He's older than Reb Chaim, for he lived in the 17th century. His name is Rabbi Shabbatai Kohen, known as the Shach, Siftei Kohen, who must be present when civil law, Dinei Mamonot, is discussed. Many more visitors arrive, some from the 11th, 12th, and 13th centuries, and others harking back to antiquity, Rabbeinu Tam, Rashi, Rambam, Ra'avad, Rashbar, Bi'akiba, and others. These scholarly giants of the past are bidden to take their seats. What he's describing here, and Norman Greenberg has pointed out to me that Levinas has done this when he discusses Reb Chaim Voloshiner. I can't tell you who came first, who stole this from whom. Doesn't matter to me. The description is Mesorah. It's the continuity, the unfolding of an oral Torah which never ceases, the enmeshing, the disappearance of generational gaps and divides. Is that the Rebbe introduces the guest to his pupils, and the dialogue commences. The Rambam states the halacha. The Ra'avad disagrees sharply, as is his wont. Some students interrupt to defend the Rambam, and they express themselves harshly against Ra'avad, as young people are apt to do. The Rebbe softly corrects the students, suggests more restrained tones. The Rashba smiles gently. The Rebbe tries to analyze what the students meant, and other students intercede. Rabbeinu Tam is called down to express his opinion. Suddenly, a symposium of generations comes into existence, because their books were never closed, because their words are continuously being spoken. In my words, young students debate earlier generations with an air of daring familiarity, and a crescendo of discussion ensues. After a 2 or 3 hour shiur, this is the cute part at the end, the Rebbe emerges from the chamber young and rejuvenated. He has defeated age. The students look exhausted, and the Mesorah experience. Years play no role. Hands, however parchment, dry and wrinkled, embrace warm and supple hands in commonality, bridging the gap which separates the generations. Thus, the old ones of the past continue their great dialogue of the generations, ensuring an enduring commitment to the Mesorah. So he's describing it as this chain of tradition of Mesorah, again, which transcends history, the passage of time, which we've developed and discussed over the course of these last several classes as something which was and is purposed to continue. It can't become ossified and antiquated. That opinion is closed up and can't be discussed and reanalyzed today. The person is, like the Chachamim say, is a siftotav dovivot bakever. He's still speaking. What they mean by that is there's still a life to it. It has not become dead and closed just because it's been transmitted to print. Lastly, I'll conclude with this. I just saw this yesterday in the book Mu'adim Uzmanim. In his introduction, in the footnote in his introduction, no less, his name is Rabbi Moshe Sternbach. He's still alive today. He's a Ra'avad. He's the head of the Eda Haredi. So it's his introduction to his first book. He ended up writing many, many books, Mo'adim Uzmanim, several books, but also Tisha B'Av Hanagot, and so many, many Talmud Dikra, many, many, many books that he wrote. Introduction to one of his first books. So what he's discussing over there is much of what we've discussed, not exactly how we discussed it, but he begins by talking about Hatam Sofer. If you recall, very briefly, Hatam Sofer without the details. The fundamental principle of Hatam Sofer was one which we very said Avi Harari said resonates with him, that the transmission of words that are oral in nature to paper is bidi'avad. The Gemara says, Ed la'asod la'adonai heferu toratecha and daf samech in gitin. We can have Talmud in print, we can have Mishnayot in print, we can write books, but that's not really the way it was supposed to be done. It helps our memory, it helps it from getting lost. It's not really the way it was supposed to be done. And as such, we have certain guidelines and so forth. Says Mo'adim Uzmanim. So let me ask you a question. So it's Yemot HaMashiach. In a minute. Okay, in a second. Right, here's Mashiach. We now restored the Sanhedrin. We're back in Israel. We're not going to be so forgetful any longer. We're going to be able to do this oral tradition thing the way it was supposed to be done. What do I do with all the books on the bookcase behind me? Should I put them in Giniza? Does Giniza make a lot of money? Do our cemeteries now become inundated with a lot of books? Because, after all, this is unideal, is it not? Furthermore, are we writing books at that point? Or are we now just turning to Sanhedrin and, in his words, to Eliyahu HaNavi? I don't know about that. I mean, I have Mishnah and Masechet Eduyot, which tells us not so fast. We're not talking halakha with Eliyahu HaNavi. But we're turning to one another and we're discussing and we're continuing the oral tradition. What are we doing going forward? He suggests the following, and I think there's a real beauty to it. He says, again, he makes clear... He says, I don't have sourcing for this. I'm talking from Sivara, but I think there's a beauty to it. He says, all the books on the bookcases behind me, we're going to keep those. They have become a part of our oral tradition. That's a reality. It may have not been purposed to be like that, but they are there. He suggests going forward, no more composition of books. So to put it in our own words, we have these books, we have these texts, we have this continuity of the oral Torah through texts. Maybe it's not the way it began, maybe it's not the way it, quote, was supposed to go, but it's the way it went. And through those texts, as we've discussed, there's been the ability to, between the lines, find the whiteness and inject our own words, to read the Ta'amim into the Mishnayot, to interpret the text of Talmud as if we're entering into the Midrash. And that will be there to stay. So to speak, whether literal or not, as we get to that ideal destination, well, now let's turn it back and actually get the real hardcore Torah Sh'Bal Peh. Now let's continue this forward. Absolutely. Let's continue the oral Torah. But maybe we won't have the necessity of putting it into books. Maybe we will. But in the sense of an ideal vision, the vision has and should, in my mind, continue to be one in which we have this oral Torah. We began with a written Torah, which was transmitted purposefully and importantly with an oral dimension, with the Ta'amim, with the Targum, and so forth. We have the oral tradition, which was purposefully deficient over here and rich over there and missing words and letters, not just to remember, but to continue it. And we will only continue perhaps getting more distilled and more pure in terms of the oral side of being able to look you in the eye and speak it to you instead of seeing it through text. But the continuity of the oral Torah has and will continue to be a facet which is of primary significance to our tradition. Baruch Adonai Le'olam. Amen v'amen.